Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is Latest Trends in Managing Denials and Appeals of Clinical Lab and Pathology Claims. The presenters are Stephanie Denham, Associate Vice President, RCM Systems and Analytics, Shifin, Incorporated, San Diego, California, and Diana Richard, Senior Director, Pathology and Strategic Development, Shifin, Incorporated, San Diego, California.
Thanks for joining us bright and early on this Tuesday morning. So today we're going to talk through denials and appeals, or trends in denials and appeals. We've done this presentation previous years, so some of this content may seem similar, but what we do is we refresh it with new trends on more recent data to understand what's shifting amongst payers and denial types and appeals and what's successful and what hasn't been successful. So that's the data set that we're going to present to you today. I do have the clicker, don't I? That's nice. So as mentioned, my name is Diana Richard. Joined by my colleague Stephanie Denham. We both have about 20 years, a little more than, experience within pathology and laboratory RCM. My focus, I started out in internal audit, working for Mr. Alsterman, who's in the back there, and Stephanie and I worked together doing internal auditing on our billing department, making sure we were compliant, we were following efficient processes. Over the last 20 years, my role has evolved to be more on the business development, strategic development side of the house. Stephanie, as well, started kind of out in the audit department many, many years ago, and then has evolved to be more on the product development, client services, financial side of the house, where really she plays a significant role in making sure there's congruency between what our operations teams need, what our clients need, what our finance team needs, and what product development needs to deliver. And so a very important role in ensuring that there's continuity across the deliverable based on the trends and challenges that we're seeing in the industry today. So we hope between the two of us, we're able to bring some interesting perspective to you this morning. So we're going to start out by giving some very specific kind of micro-level payer trend updates. Really the intent of these updates is to let you kind of know this is some of the behavior happening in the industry, some of the things you may know about, some of it might be new to you, but ultimately these are the things that drive the trends that we see at a macro level that we'll talk about a little bit later in the presentation. Then we'll get into the data. The data itself is going to be based on a study that we did for 2023 dates of service to really understand what's happening in denials, what's happening with appeals, what's successful, and then how does that compare to what we did when we did the same study back in 2021. After we get through that set, I'm going to hand the microphone back over to Stephanie. Stephanie's going to talk through some strategic appeals processes. Like I mentioned, if you've seen this presentation before, just with previous year's data, some of that content's going to look very familiar. It really is, if it's not broken, don't fix it kind of philosophy. But we'll share some lessons learned based on our experiences and where we have the opportunity to continue to improve. And then we'll end the presentation on talking through how those efficiencies, and particularly leveraging technology and automation, helps accelerate revenue when we do have to go through an appeals process. Before we get too deep into the presentation, I just want to kind of give you guys an idea of where we got the data. So Xiphon does, as most everybody in here is probably aware, we do a lot of RCM data transaction for pathology laboratory and molecular labs across the country. We have, within this data set, reflective data about 200 clients that are both in-house, do their billing in-house, as well as those that outsource their billing to us. We like that because our outsource billing processes tend to be very functionalized. We've got them set up a certain way, but our in-house customers may do them a little bit different. And so when we look at the data that we're reviewing today and creating somewhat of a trend baseline, we are taking into consideration a lot of different types of workflows and ways that our clients or ourselves could be leveraging the system to manage appeals and denial workflows and what have you. So it's not just one workflow that we're making some assumptions off of. Cumulatively, we looked at about 20 million claims worth of data as part of the survey, so it's pretty substantive. And for dates of service of January through July 2023, the data was extracted from the system in December of 2023, and we completed our analysis in the first quarter of this year. Okay. And so with that, I'm going to hand this over to you.
All right. Thanks, Diana. So let's start out by just level setting on what's happening in the industry today. Let's talk about some of the things you guys are probably seeing. Make sure we're on the same page as we start diving in. So we've got some interesting things that we've seen happen recently. Some have been ongoing for a while. Some are newer. The first thing that's on the list here is some commercial payers requiring HCPCS codes for billing. So anybody running into that? Anybody do prostate biopsies? Okay, so we have a lot of that. So keeping up with what payer expectations are so that you can get claims out the door cleanly is going to be key. We're going to talk a lot today about how to identify these types of trends and what to do about them, how to address them. So on something like a payer requiring a HCPCS code, denial management is going to be key, right? If a payer changes their policy, you need to know that they made a change, they have a new expectation, and you need to work with them differently. So that's an example of something that's happening in the industry that you've got to stay on top of. We've seen several commercial payers start to adopt, especially on the prostate biopsies, the HCPCS codes, the G0416. Some other examples that we have on the list are payers making mistakes. Anybody ever had that happen before? Okay. All right. So payers sometimes mess up. Sometimes they make an update to their system. It ends up with data that wasn't supposed to be there, maybe an incorrect fee schedule. Maybe they forget that you were in network and you start getting denials related to that. So keeping up with what the payers are doing, how they're processing your claims is going to be key in order for all of the rest of this talk to be any meaning at all. You've got to make sure you've got some good monitoring on the front end. So we're going to spend time on that. We've also seen payers that are downgrading services. So the example here is toxicology, not the only place that we've seen that. But for instance, we've seen Cigna downgrading the G0483 to the G0480 for reimbursement purposes. But again, not the only place that we've seen that. We've also got issues with payer policies on diagnosis codes, which diagnosis codes can actually be in that primary spot or which diagnosis codes should never be in a primary spot. So again, another opportunity to monitor denials to know what's going on. But then there's a couple of good things that have happened. One is we've got some loosening of restrictions on prior authorization for medically necessary genetic testing. That's definitely a positive direction for our industry. We've got a lot of cutting-edge testing that can really deliver a lot for patient care, and so it's nice to see payers starting to adopt that more regularly and allow for that type of testing for treatment. And as well, you should be aware that on March 9th, there was an increase to the physician fee schedule for Medicare. Very slight, but hey, we'll take what we can get, right? So a 1.68% increase on the Medicare physician fee schedule happened on March 9th. That's going to drive us through the rest of the year. So just some examples of changes in the industry. All of the things on this list can be monitored by you through denial management, through expect price discrepancy reporting and analytics, so making sure you know what your payer should be paying you and are they paying you that, and in monitoring industry publications. One of my favorite is the Zyphon Billing Beat. I'm just going to put that in there. If you go to our website, you can subscribe to it, and some of these changes that we've noted here you would find within that particular newsletter. But keeping up with what's happening in the industry so you can be on the lookout, as well as expect price discrepancy and denial monitoring, will go a long way for these types of issues. The top denial codes that we continue to see, these haven't really changed much. The actual codes coming on the remits that are causing us problems have been the same for years. So CO-151s for MUEs, 252s for needing additional documentation, the CO-50 for medical necessity, and the 55 for experimental. These have been the same codes we've talked about for a long time. They continue to be the ones that are most problematic, driving the need for appeals. However, it's not because of the same payer CPT combination, payer policies that are driving these. So the trick here is understanding what's shifting in the industry from a payer standpoint, because it'll require modifying things. Something you think you fixed a year ago might appear to be broken again, but it's really a new issue. So I think keeping up with denials and understanding the cause behind them is going to be key for moving things forward. I'm going to toss this back to Diana so she can walk you through some of the statistical changes and trends we've seen in the industry, and then we'll get back together and talk about what to do about it.
Cool. Thanks, Stephanie. I'm going to actually hop over here. All right, so we are breaking this information down into four different categories. One is, which is presented here, is all segments, so pathology, clinical, molecular, but then this is great, but I think it's better when we look at it segment-specific, because the trends tend to shift a little bit when we're looking at what's happening in the payer behaviors within each. To give you a little scope of this chart, because you will see it for each segment, this is our average denial averages by primary payer group across the board. So we start with contract to commercial here on the left. The blue bar on the left-hand side is our 2021 averages. The brighter blue bar on the right side is our 2023 denial rate averages as a percentage of volume, or percentage denied. And then the yellow line that goes across the screen is what percentage of volume that particular payer makes up as our population for this study. And the reason I wanted to include that yellow line this year is you'll see as it tapers off to the right-hand side of the screen, it gets really, really small volumes, these payers on the right-hand side. And so it doesn't take a lot of shift to have a dramatic impact optically when we look at the bar chart. So when we look at TRICARE contracted, which is this one right here, you'll see there's a big jump, when in reality, as the volume is so small, it might not actually have been as significant as what we would see maybe on one of these payer groups that had higher volume contributions to the population. So as you can see here across all of our segments, commercial contracted stayed flat, but as we get into the individual segments, we'll see that there actually was an increase in commercial contracted denial rates from 2021 to 2023. However, across the entire population, when we look at the individual segments as well, generally speaking, we've seen a decrease in denials across most of our major payer groups, at least for the contracted ones. We do monitor, and you'll see this along the bottom, non-contracted payer groups as well. We like to categorize all of our payer IDs into one bucket or another, just because the trends are going to be very different depending on the adjudication process. So, again, some decrease across them, but we'll get into the segment specific and get into a little bit more detail in that route. The revenue impact by appeals by segment, this is probably one of my favorite pieces of information to have. And essentially what this is telling us in 2023, for example, for molecular is 11.17% of the revenue generated by our molecular clients, and these are clients that do true complex molecular testing. They're not doing routine pathology or routine clinical. They're doing a very specific, specialized type of testing that has a very high denial rate. 11% of their revenue is generated by the appeals process, and that's up from 7% in 2021. There are a couple of things that can drive that shift. One is payer policies. Maybe they could be getting more successful on their appeal strategies and just generating revenue off the same type of appeals. It could be that there's more frequency of appeals. So there's a few different things, generally payer policies, as well as just overall strategy behind appeals. It could also mean that they've adopted some new technologies, some new testing that's come out in which there aren't really a lot of payer policies for, and so now we're having to appeal those more frequently than maybe we had appealed other tests historically. So there's a couple of things that could be driving that. Pathology tends to be a little more stable just because this is routine testing. We went up a little bit in pathology from 1.12% of total revenue generated coming from the appeals process. We're now about 1.5%. And then clinical, which is not a lot of appeals in clinical, at least per capita as far as volume is concerned, and so relatively flat, but also saw a somewhat of an increase here. What I think is important, and one of the reasons why this is one of my favorite things to kind of look at, is appeals they're not going to go away. Payers get really crafty with their denial processes. The way that we manage recoupment on that revenue oftentimes happens on the back end, particularly in cases where it's additional information or medical necessity denials, and we can't really confront that issue on the front end through an edit. This plays a big part in how groups manage expectations from a budget perspective. And so maybe in pathology, 1.5% of revenue is significant, but it's not as significant as that 11% on the molecular side. When we go through the appeals process, it pushes out our timeline to payment an additional 30 to 60, potentially even 90 days, depending on the payer. And if it makes up 11% of your revenue, it's important to be able to communicate that downstream to your executive teams, to your other leadership members, to say, hey, listen, our days in AR are lagging out a little bit, but here's what's impacted by the appeals process. So we're going to get paid. It's just taking us a little longer to get there. And having these kind of thresholds or benchmarks in order to track that against is really, really helpful. And it allows us to have some perspective on what the true impact is of this back-end process that really has become a component of our traditional workflow. Okay. So first we'll go into anatomic pathology, then we'll go into molecular, and then we'll end on the clinical lab. So for anatomic pathologies, we could see the commercial contracted, which is here on the left-hand side. We did see a slight increase in the percentage of denials that we received through the first half of 2023 as compared to same time period for 2021. However, the other payer groups, we did see a nice decline until we get over to the Blue Cross Blue Shield non-contracted, where that shot up. Again, it's a lower volume. What ended up happening is we had an AP customer that was not billing some blue out-of-state Blue Cross Blue Shield plans. They were triaging that, have now started billing them even though they're out of network. And so the percentage of volume that we had included in this population went up. But overall, for the larger payer groups, we've seen a decline. Some of this is just evolution of payer policy. I think a large part of it is we continue to look at denials on the back end and try to see how can we manage this through front-end editing. We don't want to have to deal with appeals or, you know, corrected claims or any of these things on the back end and trying to fight for the dollars. So part of the contribution comes from just strategically looking at the system and going, what more can we do on the front end of the process to prevent having to deal with this on the back end? As far as appeals are concerned, where they're necessary, these are our appeal reasons in pathology. So our top appeal reason is additional information followed by medical necessity. Process is very similar between the two. I think everybody in this room is probably familiar with additional information denials, but basically the payer is, it's not a hard denial. They're just saying send us the pathology report and or the requisition so that, you know, we can confirm that the service is being billed, we're documented and justified. So we just have to appeal with a letter and the additional information. That continues to be our number one reason for having to do follow-up on the AP side. Again, followed quickly by medical necessity. We do have some out-of-network that's gone up over the last couple of years. Prior authorization is about 13%. When we get to the molecular side, you will see that the prior auth on molecular cases is actually lower than AP, and there's a reason for that that we'll get into, but we continue to have to manage those on the back end. And then you'll see we have an other category. The way that we manage appeals in our system is they can be highly customized, which means that when groups, our clients, assign a naming nomenclature to that appeal letter, it's not always clear what it's for. Most of the time I'll do additional information appeal, medical necessity appeal, but occasionally we'll see a specific test ID that's unique to that client plus a payer name, and that's all I got. And most of those are going to be medical necessity appeals that are very, very specific to a very specific test or a very specific scenario, but for the purposes of aggregating the data in this study, it wasn't clear which of these categories it should fall into. So most of them are probably medical necessity denials, but to make sure that we were keeping the data clean and no assumptions, we categorized them into other. And you'll see after other, things exist. They just kind of taper off. And then when we go left to right, we'll see the percentage of success rate on the first attempt, the second attempt, and the third attempt, along with the average payment per appeal with paid and unpaid factored in together, as well as payment per successful appeal. So we took out any appeals that we did not get paid on, and we just looked at the ones where payment was received, what that average was. The important thing here is that, you know, in some cases, more than others, it's really important not to give up if you don't get the answer you want after the first appeal. There is some success rate on the second appeal and the third appeal. We'll see that even in the molecular side, where you have to fight a little bit harder for medical necessity and clinical utility. But, you know, the track here is to say, you know, it's a cumulative effort. In some cases, it's not worth the fight. Maybe the case value isn't worth it. We know that we're not going to get paid regardless. This is something we need to address with the client on the front end. But nonetheless, it's not a one and done in most cases on the appeal side. Okay. For molecular, again, on the commercial contracted, we saw a slight increase on the denials there, but everywhere else we saw a little bit of a deterioration, which is welcome. Again, maybe in part due to some shifts in payer policy, as well as some more front-end editing and management on the front end of the process to prevent the denials altogether. You'll see we have this really curious commercial non-contracted bucket that's missing 2023 data. We have a client that went in network with a number of their payers, and so the non-contracted commercial kind of dropped off the radar for this year because it's now factored into the commercial contracted. So I could have removed it. I did want to for integrity purposes, but that's what's causing a little bit of a blip on that particular item. Okay. From an appeals perspective, our number one appeal type in moleculars is medical necessity, which I don't think will be a surprise to anybody, quickly followed by additional information requests from payers and other, which is largely going to be back into the medical necessity bucket. And then, you know, you can see our success rates. In molecular, of course, the dollar value of these tests is much higher than what we see on pathology and clinical. So appeals, again, as a percentage of revenue, it's really, really critical on the molecular side just because of the risk of loss on tests being performed where we can't recover revenue. This plays a critical component in merging that gap. And then for clinical, we don't do a lot. There's clinical's a little bit of a different beast. There's not quite so many appeals that occur here. We did go ahead and track the denial trends by payer group. Again, the commercial contract went up just a tad. But Medicare stayed flat. Medicaid went up just a blip. And then the rest of the groups, for consistency, pretty much stayed down until you get into the non-contracted there at the end. And some of that just might be some client behavior and new billings or moving for the Medicaid, for example. If you're not contracted with Medicaid, you're probably not going to get paid. So a lot of groups are incentivized to make sure that they get in network where they need to. And so we saw a drop in the Medicaid non-contracted here over on the right, likely because we had some clients go get in network with the plans. That were causing them problems. The end. So we'll let the technical team determine what's going on here. So from a clinical perspective, on the appeals piece, we get this back up. There really wasn't a lot to report on that. Their biggest one as well is additional information, payers requesting a copy of the requisition or additional documentation to support the test. But in general, it's pretty flat on the clinical lab side. And then the slide that comes in after that is actually a list of CPT codes where we have measured the success of appeal by CPT code. We've included pathology, molecular, and clinical. If we can't get this up before the end of the presentation, it will be included in the deck that War College makes available to you all. Stephanie was going to talk through that slide a little bit. So do you want to just go ahead and do that now to give some context?
Yeah. So basically, kind of to reiterate what Diana was saying, we looked at specific CPTs in the different segments of our business. So your standard clinical laboratory CPTs versus molecular CPTs versus pathology CPTs. And when we look at that, the trend is not unexpected, but confirms probably what we already know. In the clinical lab space, very few appeals. and their relatively high success rate on those appeals, but with a relatively low dollar value return, because these are not generally high dollar tests. So it's kind of what you would expect. On the molecular side, a lower success rate, you're fighting payer policy, you're fighting new developments in testing, but with a significantly higher return when you are successful on those appeals that make those unsuccessful ones still worth the effort. In the pathology side, it kind of splits the difference. Fairly high success rate, definitely lower return than on the molecular testing, but worth the effort again. And so we're doing a lot of analysis within XIFIN, looking at how successful are different appeals that are done on different types of testing, what types of appeals tend to be successful, where are there gaps so that we can either improve the appeals process or eliminate the denial altogether. We do have, as Diana mentioned, the data for some of the top CPTs in the deck. The CPTs that we reviewed, the CPTs that we reviewed are the same CPTs you'll find on our payer rate transparency monitor that's available on the XIFIN website and also outside of the main hall for our talks today. So stop by, play with it a little bit. That is our collective representation of data published by some of the commercial payers because they're now required to provide that data. So we have our wonderful data team has been able to take this huge data set and drill it down to some of the highest volume codes for our market and provide the data that's been published. So feel free to stop by and talk to some of our folks and look at that data while you're here. We're going to move on from there. Sorry that we don't have slides, but we're going to keep on going. We're going to move on from here and talk about being strategic and how you handle your denials. So not every denial needs an appeal, right? Everybody agree with that? Okay, good. Glad we're on the same page. But if you are going to appeal, then your documentation has got to support what you're appealing. How do you make sure that happens? There's three components that should be included in your documentation if you're ever going to put it in front of a payer. Your documentation should show that every test you build was ordered, performed, and medically necessary 100% of the time. So ordered, performed, medically necessary. If you don't walk out of here with anything else, know those three words. Those may be more than three words. But your testing has to be, you have to have that documentation. If that's not documented, you might as well not have done it if you've got to put that in front of the payer. So if it's not documented, it wasn't done, and that documentation needs to support those three things, ordered, performed, and medically necessary. So I'm going to talk real quick about some published payer policies that might not require an appeal, things that if you know about them, if these are published, you can prevent them up front. You want to have edits in your billing system that's going to allow for you to resolve the issue before the claim ever goes out the door, because the best case scenario is a clean claim that gets paid the first time. Forget corrected claims, forget the appeals, let's get it right out the door the first time. So this is going to be things like correct coding initiatives, where you've got codes that the payer doesn't expect to be billed together, because typically both tests are not required to diagnose and treat the patient. But we know that sometimes you need both tests, not necessarily because it was required for a diagnosis, but because you have two different specimens that you're looking at separately. Maybe you did need both tests, though. Maybe the first test was inconclusive or not specific enough, and you need to add that second one. But when you know that the CCI edit exists, it makes sense for you to have the edits in your billing system to capture those up front. What do you do about a CCI edit? Usually you're going to review your medical records to make sure that all the testing that was done was ordered, performed, and medically necessary and is documented in your report. And if it is, you typically are going to have the opportunity to add a modifier to indicate that to the payer to get that clean claim out the door. So that's your goal with those. If you're finding that you're getting denials related to CCI edits on the back end, then really what you want to do is send corrected claims, not appeals. You want to send the corrected claim with that modifier. It's a little bit faster adjudication process than an appeal would be. And then you want to install the edit on the front end to prevent it in the future. So that's how we're going to handle CCI edits. The same thing is going to go for LCDs and NCDs. These are published payer policies. Resolve them the same way. Have them loaded in your billing system. Stop them before the claim goes out the door. Make sure that the diagnosis code that's on there is fully covered as far as being supported in your report, and make sure it supports medical necessity per the payer policy. If you can get that done, you can get the claim paid the first time. If you don't have documentation of medical necessity per the published policy, then you might need to work with your ordering physician to say, hey, got to make sure you understand when this test is appropriate to be ordered, and let's and make sure that they understand what they should do from an ordering situation, and that they provide you enough documentation so that you can appropriately diagnose this code for that. We also have things like MUEs. MUEs is one of those things that we all should be aware of, but that we can't usually get a clean claim out and avoid the denial. So when you're billing Medicare specifically and they have a published MUE, we are typically finding that we have to appeal those with the documentation. So MUEs can't necessarily be avoided. When you do the appeals, though, when you have to submit an appeal, there is an accepted three-cycle appeal process when it comes to Medicare, and most payers have something similar. So a first-level appeal is going to be that you provide the documentation that you have to support the service and maybe a letter explaining why the service was performed, why it was necessary. You're going to have that solid documentation that says it was ordered, performed, and medically necessary, and get that over to the payer to resolve that denial and hopefully get paid. So first-level appeals are typically going to a medical professional, but a lot of times these are RNs, they're registered nurses, so they have a general healthcare background. They understand healthcare and services that are being provided to diagnose and treat patients, but they probably didn't come out of the laboratory. They probably don't know your testing specifically. They probably don't have much experience with genetic tests. So it's really important that you make sure your documentation is clear enough for a healthcare professional that might not know your specific testing to review and still say, yes, I understand why you performed this test and why it was necessary. Even better, when there's a published payer policy, that you take language directly out of that payer policy and use it somewhere in your report. So if you've got a policy that says this testing should be used for this type of sign or symptom, connect those dots for them so that when that RN reads your documentation, they say, oh, I see what you did here. Here's my policy. I get it. I'm going to pay you for this service. So do the best you can to connect those dots in those reports. If the first level appeal, your first attempt, is not successful, you might decide you need to refine your documentation and send another first level appeal. That's an acceptable practice. So just because you file a second appeal doesn't mean you're sending a second level appeal. If you get past that first appeal, though, and you say, they're not getting it, I think I'm right, they're wrong, then it's time to go to a second-level appeal. Second-level appeal is typically going to go to an outside independent contractor. It's going to be reviewed by a whole different group of people, not by that particular Medicare program itself. And what you'll want to do here is attach additional documentation from a genetic counselor or a physician that supports the services that were done. This is your opportunity to provide all the documentation you can to support it, to potentially have that denial overturned. When the second level appeal isn't successful, you might decide to go to a third level, which is an administrative law judge. This is a pretty aggressive step. You want to be pretty confident where you're going here before you go this path. You also might annoy the payer a little bit. So this is one of those, if you have a large volume of claims that you feel like they are not handling appropriately and you choose to go to the ALJ, you might want to try out a handful of claims with the ALJ, and if they are successful, take that back to the payer to say, hey, do you want me to keep going down this path, or can you fix the problem on your end? And then they might work with you a little bit better. So those are the three levels of appeals. I heard a story recently that I want to share because I think it's relevant here. A gentleman went into a mental health facility, sat down with the administrator of the facility and said, how do you decide which people need to be admitted for care? And he said, oh, we give them a test. We fill up a bathtub with water. We give them a teaspoon, a teacup, and a bucket, and we tell them to empty the bathtub. And the gentleman said, oh, okay, I get it, because people who don't need to be admitted will use the bucket. It's the biggest thing. And he said, no, the people who don't need to be admitted will pull the plug in the bathtub. So, and then he asked him where he'd like his bed. So I say that to say two things. First of all, those of us who have chosen to be in revenue cycle for a long time maybe should have a psychological evaluation. And secondly, that sometimes we're using the bucket, right? So sometimes we're approaching denials and how to follow up with denials with a bucket. It works. It'll get you there, but it's not the best solution. So let's talk a little bit about what that looks like. We still don't have presentation slides. Sorry about that. There are a couple of approaches, right? Appeals are a way to get reimbursed. They're not always the best way. You're better off when you can to avoid the appeal process altogether and utilize corrected claims, or even better yet, get the clean claim up front. Now, so where you can, install those payer edits in the front end, create errors prior to the claim processing or the claim filing process, and correct the issues on the claim before it ever goes out the door. When that's not possible, so take something like a medically unlikely edit where they're not going to do that. When you can, automate the appeals process, right? So you're going to try to get a clean claim out the door. Where it's not a clean claim, it might be something you can handle through a corrected claim. That's your kind of second best solution. And when it can't be a corrected claim and has to be an appeal, try to automate it. By doing that, you're going to be pulling the plug, right? That's the process you want to go down. Can I get the claim clean? If not, is a corrected claim warranted, and then I can get future claims clean? And if not, can I automate my appeal? The other thing that we're seeing more of now in the industry is the ability to submit documentation, unsolicited and solicited claim attachments through other means besides appeals. So understand what's available to you there and try to get the documentation out instead of going through the appeals process. If you can get it to the payer early in the process and avoid the denial, you're going to be much better off. The things that you can do through corrected claims and resolve are going to be your published payer policies, your CCIs, your NCDs, LCDs. Anywhere you can do that, take advantage of it. And from an automated appeal standpoint, things like MUEs. The payer will pay. You just got to provide the documentation to go with it. Remember, anytime you provide your documentation to a payer, you're providing your documentation to a payer. Ordered, performed, medically necessary. Not just for the test you're appealing, for everything that's on the claim. Make sure the documentation is solid and supports what you're doing. So that's really all of our material. I think we're going to drop to some Q&A if you guys have any questions for us. So the question, let me make sure I understood you correctly, was how do we get the documentation to the payer ahead of having to do an appeals process?
Ahead of even a request for the documentation.
Gotcha. So how do we get unsolicited claim attachments that will support the billings to the payer ahead of time? So this is still on the new end in our industry, but we are seeing payers starting to open up API calls where you can do a submission of that documentation. I think usually there's a requirement that there's an identifier on the claim that a document's coming, so they know to be looking for it, and then they offer a submission mechanism to get the document to them. Right now, what our experience is it's only a handful of payers, but there are more rolling out. The one that we're super excited about, because they're a little bit challenging, especially when you come into molecular testing, is UHC. And so we're working with UHC, who's trying to get this rolled out now. But it's not a lot of payers yet, but there's definitely the movement in that direction in the industry. Yeah. Yes?
So what's the best way to manage new CPT codature and submissions in a traditional or standard test family? So if the codature changes, maybe a more sensitive platform and what would normally be perceived as a traditional immunoassay, for instance, and you're trying to educate on the payer side to make sure your codature is true, but they're not used to seeing it. So what's the best way to manage that?
Okay, so the best way to manage filing new codes for testing you've been doing, but maybe there's a new code that's been released, and making sure the payer policy will accurately handle the billing of this new code. Is that the question? Yeah, okay. Fortunately, when you have new codes published, you've got AMA behind you because they've identified that this needs to be called out. Sometimes getting payer policy to catch up with that is a little bit challenging. The best thing you can do in those situations is engage your managed care team and their contacts at the payers to work with them about what it is you're doing, what the testing is, what their current payer policy is for that test, and try to get alignment. Sometimes that takes a lot of effort and a lot of conversations and a lot of documentation, but definitely engaging those resources is going to be key.
And we've seen clients as well use more routine codes, let's say like wound care for 87798. We had a pathology customer using that for a purpose that was that code was intended to be used for, but not the primary purpose, that code. And so payers weren't used to seeing a code with that methodology attached to a claim, and we would get denials. So what we ended up doing is creating a custom appeal letter to educate the payer. We waited until we had a certain volume of overturns on the denials to say the payer's now getting it, that they're paying for it under the circumstance, and then we took that information back to the payer and said, hey, listen, we can cut out this part of the process if you just stop denying for these scenarios, because every time we appeal it, you pay. So if it's an existing code, they're just not used to seeing in that format, but from a compliance perspective, it is applicable. Then managing it again on the back end, getting that data, and then going back to the payer to make the argument helps.
But obviously, you're resubmitting under the CodeShare for to maximize your return. Mm-hmm. So you're trying to avoid the traditional low reimbursement level, and so your suggestions were really great. So thank you.
Okay. So, looking at all this, documentation. So what's out there? Grab the provider or facility that may be on a paper record or faxing something in or whatever. I mean, you can't, strong arm your clients. So is there anything in that instance to help us get documentation in to even get to these processes?
So generally speaking, unless you're on the molecular side and they're asking for clinical history and medical records, most of the documentation the payer is requesting comes from the LAS. So it'll be the pathology report, the requisition. But to your point, as payers potentially overcomplicate the process from our perspective. One of the things that we do is we offer our customers a client portal, and that allows our customers to communicate billing requests back to their client in a secure means. Their client, we can send additional information requests and whatnot back to their customer. The customer can submit them through the portal. They come directly into the billing system. It's not the solution, but it helps streamline the need for today. I think, it's a challenging question because payers do, this is what they do because a lot of people don't respond and it creates a backlog. But hopefully, using prior authorizations as an example to payers probably overutilizing something in order to drive behaviors that favor them and overusing prior authorizations to drive denials, knowing that X percentage of groups are not going to respond to that request or they're never going to have to pay out that claim. States start getting involved. Government, Congress start getting involved. That's where we get the Gold Card Act and other things where we have some other level of intervention that kind of controls the payer behavior back down to a more rational level. So I think part of it is going to become an advocacy and maintaining some diplomacy between what the payers are trying to control and what seems realistic. Because ultimately, if it's penalizing the provider, it's also penalizing the patient. And the more that they penalize the patient, the more restrictive access to care is going to become. And again, when we talk about prior authorizations and how daunting that is for both the provider and the patient and some of the most unfortunate events that have happened as a result of patients not getting care in a timely manner, it gives us the leverage, I think, to be able to push back should payers continue down this path of requesting a tremendous amount of information that ultimately isn't going to change the outcome of their decision.
Mm-hmm. Is there any data where you have the ability to come up with data that would give us an idea of what the payer is looking for? One of your comments earlier was most payers just want what I call the primary documents, mm-hmm. which are the requisition and mm-hmm. the report, right?
Yeah.
But if folks in the field understood more of what that peer really wants, then it would help them to be able to utilize the system more effectively. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know if that's something that you might have in your back pocket or maybe be able to share at a later date.
We definitely have a lot of experience working with the payers and trying to address their documentation requests. Obviously, on the molecular side of the house, there is more of like the notes that are needed for you might need something from a genetic counselor. You might have a lot of other documentation besides just a lab report. And I think that just we have a lot of experience with that. So yes, I'm sure we have the data somewhere. I don't have a little list in my back pocket, but we do have a ton of expertise across the system. So if there's certain areas where you're struggling, we're happy to try to see what we can put together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Tim.
Yeah. Sure. So the question was, how do you get proof that the payer, Medicare or another payer, has taken their steps that are required, their due diligence, to get the documentation from the ordering physician as opposed to burdening the ancillary provider with the request? We personally, that I know of, have not taken the steps to push on that, because what we've seen is, while I agree that that's a step that should be taken, the ordering physician doesn't have any skin in the game. So even if they get the request, hopefully they like you enough that they're going to send it in to help you out. But really, that's a level of effort that doesn't directly benefit them. And so we found that the providers who just take the ownership of it themselves and have good processes in place, if that includes up to it working directly with your ordering physician to say, we need your support in this, help me get it, and I'll do the submission, that those providers tend to be a little more successful than the ones counting on the ordering physician to fill that gap.
Oh, sure.
So.
I've actually been successful with that at ALJ.
Good. Okay.
So he
mentioned he's been successful in the ALJ with not being able to get that proof that it's been handled. So that's good to know. Thank you for sharing that. So
then
we have two up, so we'll go back there first and then we'll come up here.
Go ahead, Jay.
My question is about prior auth and molecular. When you see that the prior auth is denied on the molecular, but the lab proceeds with testing and you go through the appeals process, are you seeing successful prior auth, or are they just now denying because it was denied at that point before the order?
So if we had the slides, we would pull back up the molecular one. But when you get a copy of it, on the molecular side, the prior auth appeals, the success rate is in there. So there is some success rate when we're retroactively appealing a prior auth denial. What a lot of our molecular customers do is they've, because it is such a predominant requirement in that segment of our industry today, is they've put in, they've done a really good job of putting in some front-end processes, such as, at least for speaking on behalf of Xyphon, we've got integrations into two or three vendors where if we have a case that comes into our system that meets the criteria of a prior authorization requirement, but that prior auth field is missing or is blank, the system will throw that error out through an API call to one of those integrated vendors. They'll make the request to the payer, and if it's successful and a prior auth number is returned, it populates in that field, and then the case proceeds through the system. So we do, kind of going back to front-end edits, if we know a case is going to hit a criteria every single time for prior authorization, we try to control that on the front end of the process and bill it out with that prior auth before it goes out the door so we don't have to deal with the appeal. But there is some success rate when things get through and Maybe a new payer requirement is out there with prior auth, and then that lands and we have to appeal it. There is some success. I think it's like in the 23,
it's about 15%.
15? Okay, thank you.
I think the other thing to consider with the start of the gold card process is to make sure that you want to make sure that when you're dealing with prior authorizations that you're going to be successful on them. So having some type of screening on the front end so that you can have successful prior authorization requests, it will benefit you long term. At Zyphon, we've actually installed on the molecular side some genetic counselors to help with that, because we know that in order to be successful in something like a gold card situation, you need to have proven that you're successful in getting the prior auths and that you have those controls in place. So I would advise that you review what you're doing on the front end to request those and try to increase that success rate as much as possible. We're out of time, but I know we have one more question, but if you'd like to connect after the session, I'd be happy to chat with you. Cool. All right, well, thank you all joining us. We appreciate it.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.